Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is When Orla Met, a conversation about the highs and lows, the chase for happiness and success, and the incredible characters to be found in the world of sport. I'm hugely grateful to Twist Teas for supporting this podcast. I need a bit of a boost today, so I'm going for their Refresher Green Tea with functional herbs for pick-me-up. Twist Teas blend the finest whole-leaf teas, herbs and fruits, and are full of little surprises. So brew yourself a cuppa and enjoy. In the previous episode of When Orla Met, I caught up with Pippa York, previously the champion cyclist Robert Miller. Pippa talked to me about the difficulty of competing at the top level of male sport while dealing with gender dysphoria, and how she coped in a macho environment when on the outside she was still Robert, but on the inside knew she was really a woman. Being trans was, and is, in Pippa's words, an awful situation. And that's where we pick up over a sometimes rather noisy cup of tea of our own for part two of When Orla Met Pippa York.
So who was the first person you told, do you remember?
When I went for therapy. That would be the first person.
So your therapist before anyone close to you?
When I sought medical help, that would be the first person. So they would ask you the questions that they have to ask you. And you answer as honestly as possible, otherwise there's no point being there.
What was that experience like, saying the words out loud for the first time?
It was okay, actually, because then there's that realisation that, yeah, you are going to have to deal with it. And you get kind of past it. You might go so far down one path that and you're okay, you're stuck there. And that you're kind of happy at that level, and you might be the kind of full transition thing, and that's where you kind of reach a level where you're happy.
And do you mind me asking how it played out? You were married. How did it play out with your wife at the time?
And my marriage failed, not because of the trans stuff, because we didn't look after each other. Basically, I didn't look after her, she didn't look after me. It didn't fail because of the trans stuff. So that's kind of, people say, oh, I know it's been reported that I kind of abandoned my wife and son. I didn't. But I'm not going to, at the time, I'm not going to come forward and say I haven't, because then I'm going to give them more information to what I am doing. So that didn't happen. But for me, you'd have to ask my ex-wife what her feelings was. But for me, it was because we didn't look after each other.
And do you have any kind of relationship with her? What's your relationship like with your son?
I have a relationship with my son. I don't have a relationship with my ex-wife, no.
And how is your son about it all now, then?
He's okay with it, yeah. We've fallen out, but we haven't fallen about the gender stuff. You know, you fall out with your offspring about other stuff, and we've fallen out. We fell out a couple of years ago, but now we're talking again, so that's fine.
So what was the period of post-retirement like then? It sounds like you had decided, you knew that post-retirement was when you were going to tackle the rest of your life, I guess.
I tried my best to get involved with the British Cycling Federation, but I didn't feel in any way that they wanted me to be there. So when that ended, I then decided I wasn't going to have anything to do with the cycling world anymore. And that kind of coincided with having started to deal with the gender stuff when my kind of personal life started falling apart. So the kind of two went together. It was a kind of gradual process of removing myself from cycling stuff and dealing with the gender stuff at the same time.
And did you very deliberately need to step back at that stage from any kind of public life and keep your privacy 100%?
I'd given enough of myself as a cyclist. So all that kind of intrusion into your privacy, I couldn't deal with that, dealing with the gender stuff. You can't have that kind of intrusion into your personal medical history. So I kept my privacy well locked down then.
And how long did that whole process take from, I guess, retirement and putting the cycling part of your life to bed for that stage in your life anyway, to acceptance as Pippa?
The end of my stuff would have been 2002, and I'd have been about halfway through the transition stuff then. So my transition started at the end of 99, beginning of 2000, and it kind of reached the end point halfway through 2003. So for 2 years of it, I dealt with both parts.
And you thought at that stage that was it, as we were saying earlier, that you would never be in the public eye again, you would never be involved in cycling again.
I didn't want to be in the public eye again because I didn't want to deal with that level of intrusion, because it's quite hard to... I'd already had that whole media intrusion into my privacy from the national newspapers.
Because they had tracked you down while you were transitioning, wasn't that right?
So they came and doorstepped me while I was transitioning, which is a really kind of difficult, horrible thing to do. So it's one of the worst moments of your kind of life transition, because it's not an instant kind of, I'll be Philippa tomorrow. It takes years. So during those years, it's pretty horrible. When somebody comes and takes that privacy and everybody laughs at you and think, oh, what a weirdo, what a freak, because that's how it was reported at the time, it's a pretty horrible thing to do. So that kind of made me even more private. So then I moved house, changed names, and probably no way of finding me, so that I can have some kind of peace of mind when I'm at home.
So I can't possibly imagine what that must have been like, because you would have read what had been written, and as you say, the lack of acceptance even as recently as that meant that, and I guess because of your privacy, then it became easier to poke fun, and it became easier to ridicule and make you into some sort of a caricature in some way.
The thing is, now everybody has the chance to put their side of the story, so you don't have to give in. I could publish a blog and say what I wanted to say, whereas before, the only people who had access to publishing was the media, so they could put out any story, and if you wanted to refute that, you had to go through them.
But to be public.
But to go through them, then you give up even more privacy. So people write stuff about you and they know nothing about you. And then everybody assumes that that's true because that's the only story that they've got. So when I look at those kind of stories of I left my wife and kids and abandoned them and nobody knows where to find me, those people just look ridiculous now, because it comes out that they've always known where to find me. They can phone me at any moment, and during the 25 years I've left, they've known where to find me every day. And they just look ridiculous because they publish stuff that blatantly isn't true, but they'll still publish it because it kind of promotes that idea that the whole kind of gay rights stuff is marginal and ridiculous and these people are weaker.
How much have you been following how the media and public have been changing their attitudes toward these kinds of things? I'm looking at the likes of Caitlyn Jenner, for example, another immensely high profile former athlete, and the praise and positivity that she has received. How were you watching any of that with any interest?
I watched the start of her kind of coming out thing, and she made the same kind of mistakes that Kelly Maloney made, of assuming that her experience was everybody's experience. But now she's kind of realised that, you know, the only not least that she has is her own. But I kind of followed that stuff, and you know, at first it was poorly presented, even though they tried to keep control of it. It was kind of presented as what I'd call makeup and shopping. So you know, that was her life. You know, she put on makeup and she went shopping, and that whole kind of lipstick and makeup stuff, and that's not normal, kind of normal world. That's not my world. So it's kind of hard to get involved with that and say, you know, I at the time I couldn't say, you know, that's not the real world. You know, all the kind of forums that we kind of have as support, because most people have, you know, there's some kind of support for whatever issue you've got. Now everybody's saying, oh, that's kind of ridiculous, it's just turned into lipstick and makeup and hairdos and going shopping and buying these shoes and being here and taking photos, and that's not most people's experience. So you look at that and you can see a kind of gradual acceptance, a kind of gradual, it started with tolerance. It started with a kind of tolerance because it was entertaining in a kind of foolish way, and then it became a little bit more educated as they got a better control on it, so they could talk about certain issues, and it wasn't just about going shopping and having your hair done and having your nails done and buying these shoes and being seen wearing this and that. So it kind of matured.
Because I guess, was there a danger with that? You mentioned the word entertainment, and that's exactly what it... But it was packaged and polished for our entertainment,
yeah,
when actually it was this.
And it's Caitlyn Jenner's medical history. It's her medical privacy that she's presenting, but it's packaged as entertainment. And it's her kind of... And I'm sure there were times when she filmed and she fell apart, because it's packaged... Your kind of deepest, innermost kind of thoughts and feelings are processed as entertainment. And if you think about that, if you think everybody has some kind of medical issue, if most people would be horrified if that was presented on a TV program. So, but in kind of in the trans world, it's, oh, have you have this? Has this happened to you? Or have you done that? And it's oh, that's quite interesting. But what they mean is we're quite nosy and we need to know. People say, oh, I need to know. And you say, well, need to know what? It's got nothing to do with you.
So do you, I mean, are you uncomfortable with that level of interest? I mean, I'm conscious, I'm obviously sitting here and asking you these questions.
I can see you thinking about it.
Well, yeah, obviously, because it's not anything that I'm lucky enough to have been born in the body that I believe that I was supposed to be in.
But even then, if you had some kind of medical issue, which was kind of... If it was a private medical issue and somebody asked you to talk about it on TV, you're not always going to do that. You know, you're not. It's like male erectile dysfunction and female problems with waterworks and stuff. People don't talk about that stuff. But there's this kind of idea that trans people are going to talk about operations and... Have you had, like I said, have you had this done and that done? Have they poked you with this and this? Who did that to you? It's just pure nosiness. But and you can't. Some people will give up that privacy, but sometimes you just can't for your own mental health.
I feel like I have to explain, because I can hear the English national anthem playing here, and it's a Six Nations afternoon. So just in case that comes across in the recording, they'll be wondering why "God Save the Queen" is playing. Was that a concern for you then before coming out, I guess, in that once you've said who you are now, that people feel they've got a right to ask you about all of these things?
Well,
and
do.
Not just that.
People do. And, you know, you kind of... Depends on the person, depends on the interview, depends on the kind of where you are with yourself, and sometimes you sell them and sometimes you won't, just because... It depends on the person, the circumstances, and how I feel about it. I'm never going to publish it in the newspaper, that's for sure.
And so I go back, I guess, to you deciding to come out, and you said that you wanted to be involved in cycling again and a high level of punditry. Why did you decide that you wanted to rediscover this again? And how much of a journey was it to feel confident enough in yourself, as you say, that you're willing to accept that people are going to be asking these questions whether you want to answer them or not?
I think if you separate the kind of privacy issues from the professional side of the kind of punditry stuff, since there's more and more cycling on TV, there's more and more people doing the expert part. And sometimes I would sit and watch that and notice things which they hadn't noticed, and I, instead of shouting at the TV, why wouldn't I be there saying, you know, did you see that, this is what's going to happen next? So having been a pro bike rider, you have a kind of insight to how the race is going to develop, and so you notice how people kind of move and different things, and you kind of get a feeling for the race, even if you're watching it from the outside. And I think it's worthwhile to give that to people because there's more kind of interest in it, and it's a kind of deeper interest, whereas before it was just a Tour de France, now it's a whole year thing. So it's a kind of deeper interest, and people want to know the details, and you can only really spot the details if you've been following it for a long time. And the kind of privacy thing, well, there's only so much of my privacy I'm going to give up to a kind of acceptable level, and that's how it is.
Before we continue, I want to take a quick tea break to say a huge thanks to Twist Teas for supporting this podcast, because there's nothing like a chat and a cup of tea to lift the spirits. Twist Teas have a range of 24 different blends with or without caffeine. So whether you're looking for a morning pick-me-up or an afternoon soother, you're bound to find a tea to suit. You can pick from their classic blend to peppermint with a hint of chocolate, or functional herbs to give you a boost. Have a look. There really is a blend to suit pretty much every mood, or you can suggest blends of your own. Go to their website, twist-teas.co.uk. So are you enjoying cycling again?
As a cyclist or watching?
Well, as a fan, I guess. I don't know if you ever were a fan, even. I don't know.
To be a bike rider, you have to be a fan. So you have to have studied all that stuff before, so you've done a little... You've looked at who's been a rider before and the kind of history of it, and you have bits that interest you more than other bits. So as a fan, certain parts of the season interest me and certain parts don't.
So what interests you and what doesn't?
So the kind of, I like watching certain classics, and I like watching certain stage races, and some of the races I don't watch at all. Because I probably didn't enjoy them as a rider, so I've got no interest in following them. So unless something really spectacular happens, if the thing is, when you've done so many races, you know how most races go, even though they're 20 years ago. You know how that race is conducted. So to watch it and sit and watch it, and the guys go through the motions of it, and you'll know how it's going to end up, I find that quite boring. And I don't know if that's just me, or if I'm sure other people find it quite boring as well. So, but things like the classics and the major stage races, they're a lot more interesting.
Do you have a favourite current rider at all?
Probably Peter Sagan, like everybody, because he has a strong character, and when he talks now, it's with a level of maturity that he didn't have when he was a young rider. So, and that's really interesting, that he's not kind of got that whole PR stuff pressed, being soaked into him, that he just says the kind of standard statement at the end of races, you know, he always say what he thinks and he'll lose the plot now and again, which is really interesting, because that's what people want to see. They want to see characters.
What do you think of the current British setup, which is very different from the day when you were one of the only native English speakers in the professional peloton?
I used to do races and I'd be the only English speaker sometimes. Not even, sometimes there'd be no Americans or no Australians, so you'd be the only English person, kind of English speaking person there. It's really interesting the way it's developed, and I think what's most interesting about it is at the time people used to say, why aren't there more British riders? I said, because they haven't invested in it, because they haven't thrown the money at the resource, put resources into having the structure there that people feel that they can do cycling and have the kind of support behind it. So that if you put money behind it, then you'll get cyclists like every other country does. So they've put the money into it and we have cyclists at the front.
How do you think you would have fared if the British Cycling Academy system, for example, was up and running when you were riding? Would you have thrived in that environment, or would you always have wanted to go it alone?
The environment wouldn't have psyched me at all, because the environment that they have is just the same as a pro bike team. So you go, and when I first went to France and went to ACBB, which is the top amateur club, that was more professional than British Cycling Federation was at the time. So to fit into that system for me was quite easy because I looked at it and said that this is what I need to do to progress. So you accept that that's the system. Would I have been accepted into the academy system? I don't know, because I'm not a track rider and it's mainly track focused. So then you're looking at the other kind of pathways through it with the Dave Raver Fund. Mm-hmm. Well, those guys, so they have a kind of different, more road orientated, and it may well have been I wasn't, my 59 or 60 kilos as a track rider wouldn't have been any good because I'm too small, I don't have enough raw power. So I probably wouldn't have fitted into that kind of academy stuff. So then I would have followed the Dave Raver stuff.
Which is a charity really set up to fund riders who are outside of the academy system.
Outside of the academy, so I think the Yates brothers came through that way. So, you know, they're the same kind of size of rider as I was. You know, you're roughly about 60 kilos and you don't have the raw power that needed for the track.
So you're kind of going full circle, I guess, in some respects, in that we spoke, I think, before I put the recorder on, that you went back to Scotland for the first time in 20 years recently.
Yeah.
And that was quite an emotional experience, wasn't it?
That was really difficult because all those people, I had to make a conscious decision to remove them from my life because I couldn't, not that I didn't trust them, but I didn't want to burden them with my privacy. And it's quite hard to see people that you really liked and who you respected. They missed you as much as I missed them. So that was a really, probably difficult thing to deal with. Especially as it's just kind of, the way the television programme was done, they kind of like, okay, when in, this is the first time you've met, normally you kind of get time to process that. So that was quite emotionally difficult, yeah.
And what was it like for you to reconnect with these people? Was it what you'd hoped it would be, or I don't know if you had expectations?
I mean, obviously they'd already seen all the stuff previously, so they had this. So it's not a shock to them if you just walked in and said, "Okay, this is who I am now." So to do that to people isn't the kind of right way to deal with it. So since they kind of saw the public statement and they've got used to the idea, and they knew I was coming, so they have time to kind of settle into the idea of what it's going to be. But it is still quite a challenge for people that people who have known you previously don't always know how to behave at first. You know, there's a little bit of, oh shit, this is going to happen. I'm going to have to deal with this now. And you can see, and not everybody has that kind of experience, because they'll know gay people, but nobody knows any trans people. You know, it's rare.
Did it add to your level of self-acceptance in any way, or did you need that in any way? No,
it didn't add to my acceptance. No, no.
You'd done that.
I'd already reached that point. Mm-hmm. 2007, around about then. That when I kind of left the whole cycling thing behind, I didn't know who'd won the Tour de France for 2 years, and so I didn't really follow it. So I kind of reached an acceptance with myself of where I was. So the kind of recent stuff is nothing to do with acceptance. I think it's more about people seeing me comfortable as who I am now, and they kind of realise that the person I wasn't before wasn't that comfortable.
And we talk about a greater level of acceptance now than before, and yet there are no openly gay men in professional cycling. There are some openly gay women on the women's side of it, but across any sport, we have very few. I would imagine being openly trans would be much more difficult, because then you've got a whole other issue involved. But we still, it all still feel like we talk a lot about acceptance, when actually for the people who are going through that, they maybe don't feel that that's what they would receive if they were to come out.
The crazy thing is that the cycling model is set up by sponsorships, and those big sponsors, they're usually big companies. They have a whole system of dealing with what I call the gay spectrum, and they have no issue with it at all. But when it's something representing that company, there seems to be this reluctance, or I don't know if it's just the culture that exists in pro sport, that you can't be different.
Is it that you can't be different, or you can't be any less macho than you, than you're expected to be?
It's probably that you can't be any less. You can't show any kind of weakness, because being gay anywhere on that gay spectrum is seen as a weakness in the macho world. That you can't show that, because you'll get more abuse from the side of the road than you get already if you're not. If when you cycle in certain places and you're not the kind of hometown person, you get abuse. That's just part of it, you know. It's like going to a football match and half of them are swearing at one set of guys and half of them are swearing at the other ones. It's the same in cycling. You come along and people are swearing at you or cheering or couldn't care less.
Throwing urine over you, whatever.
Yeah, that kind of stuff, you know, that's always existed. So you can just imagine the whole kind of homophobic stuff that would come out then. So I understand the reluctance, but there's certainly no backup in any of the teams which would allow you to show any kind of gayness, any kind, anywhere on that gay spectrum. None at all. It's not, like you said, it's that whole macho culture of everybody's straight white male and that's it.
So how confident would you be that if there's someone right now in professional cycling in particular going through what you went through back in the day, that they would feel confident in any way, at least even telling someone what they were going through?
They might tell somebody, but I think it will still be difficult for them to lose that kind of what's going to happen to me if I do come out as a gay cyclist. And it's like, if you look at the rugby players that have come out, they're celebrated. And rugby is way more macho than football and cycling. It's way, you know, those guys hurt each other. There's no falling over and screaming like there is in football and that kind of stuff in it. So you wonder what it is about the kind of culture that it's okay in rugby, but it isn't okay in the kind of other sports.
Is it because it's not been done? Is it that there's precedent? Is it maybe now that you're becoming a bit more public that might encourage others behind you? Or would that be your hope even?
I'd like to think that people... You know, you go to do a job in a kind of professional sporting arena, and does it matter what you do in your privacy? Who you're in love with? Who you're attracted to? It doesn't.
But or it shouldn't.
It ought not to matter, but for some reason there's a whole reluctance. And if you look at even the setup of the backroom staff, there's no openly gay people. And you think of those, and it's a prevalence of 5-6%. So you've got 200 riders at Tour de France, 5-6% of that turns into 10 or 12 people. And they're not that environment is not in any way accepting enough for them to say who they're attracted to or who they're with. And the public doesn't care, the sponsors don't care. But for some reason, the kind of whole culture of the teams and the organisations which kind of lead the thing is they don't dare say anything. It's just crazy.
How would that change, do you think?
That is going to change when the young riders who are coming through school nowadays and they get taught different, mm-hmm. a different education standard where it's, okay, so-and-so is gay, and they go, oh, yeah, fair enough. Are we going out tonight or not? Mm-hmm. Are we going to the cinema? I don't care about that. That's not my problem. That's nothing to do. Well, not nothing to do with me. That's okay.
They say
that's okay. Those people who are going through that education system now, in 10 years' time, they're going to be pro bike riders or they're going to be pro footballers, and they're not going to say, "Oh, they're not going to deny who they are."
They're not going to go back into the closet.
No, they're not, because it's not what they've been taught, and thankfully, it's not what they've been taught. You know, you bring your children up to, and you want it to be a better world for them. And it's not a better world denying who they are. So hopefully that will change gradually, that, you know, that gay people will come through those stuff like the academy, And nobody says them because they're not there because they're gay. They're there because they're a good cyclist or they're a good footballer. And that's all that matters. And that's in terms of watching it from the outside as an entertainment point of view. Their sexuality doesn't matter. You're there to watch them ride fast or kick a football well. You're there to watch that entertainment for what it is, not because of who they are. So that will change just by kind of gradual erosion of that kind of old-fashioned culture. And for me to, the thing is that I'm not standing up and saying I'm a gay icon and all that stuff. I've come back into cycling because I want to do the kind of part which professionally I can do, and I just happen to be trans. That's all it is. I'm not going to be known as trans who does the professional stuff. I'd rather I just happen to be whatever it is I am, and that's the only way you're going to change the kind of culture.
So coming back into cycling, and tonight, going back to British cycling dinner for the first time in over 20 years.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
It'll be okay. I'm kind of used to the public kind of persona that I have to present. I'll be okay with it. It won't be as daunting as the ones I did at Ruler Classic, where it's kind of the first ones I did, and it's quite emotional, and my daughter's there, and she starts crying, so then I start crying, so there'll be none of that, hopefully I won't cry.
So Ruler Classic is an exhibition of all things cycling, essentially, that happens in London once a year. I didn't realise your daughter was there, and how is she with everything now?
She's fine. She's grown up with Pippa, so for her it's fine. We don't have any issues that we have. I've got nothing to do with that. We've got nothing to do with the kind of, it's a parenting thing.
Just being human.
It's a human condition that we suffer from. It's not the other stuff.
So just finally, what's next for you? What do you foresee the future being? And are you excited about it, maybe more than before? Or
I think it'll be different to what I envisioned it was going to be for my last 10 years of a kind of active life before I really do retire. So I think it'll be a different world to the one I envisaged.
In what way?
In that I will have a kind of professional activity to do, and I won't have to feel that I'm ashamed and have to hide and, oh no, you're trans, you shouldn't be out in public, that kind of feeling, which existed before. So yeah, so I'll do stuff with Stonewall and the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, that kind of stuff, because I feel it's the right thing to do.
Happiness is such a nebulous concept, but if you can in any way grade it, I'm not asking you to grade it because that's incredibly reductive, but are you happy? Are you
people
happy?
Have asked me where I am on the grading system, and I would say probably about an 8 out of 10.
That's high.
Which is quite high. Obviously, the last 2 points is because of, okay, presentational issues, which most women have, I have all those issues of, I don't like this about myself, and I don't like that, and I wish I was 20 years younger.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that whole kind of stuff. But who I've kind of become, I'm quite happy with.
And you're happy in a woman's world then?
And I'm happy living in this woman's world, yeah. Not because I know how it all works, but for me to kind of function in it is easier than it was before.
Perfect. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Since I sat down with Pippa, she's become ever more reintegrated into the world of cycling, with more commentary and even going back to races to see some of the men she used to ride alongside who now manage teams in the sport. She seems to be really enjoying this new lease of life, which she no doubt was before she decided to let the public and media back into her life. But I'm incredibly grateful that she has allowed us back in again for so many reasons, not least to gain a
bit of an understanding of some of the incredibly complex issues that she and others like her have to face. Well, coming up in the next episode of When Orla Met.
You've got to get kids to a stage where they actually love the torture of losing. For so many years, I'd been smashed up a lot in the media as the pushy mum that's, you know, sort of pushed them all the way in, and nothing could be further from the truth.
That's in the next episode of When Orla Met. A big thank you to Jonathan Rowe for editing this episode, and a huge thanks as well to Twist Teas for their support. I'm finally going to try some of their summer specials and cold brews next time. If you have any thoughts on what you've heard so far, do get in touch via email orla@whenorlamet.com, and you can leave comments and follow me on Twitter and Instagram @whenorlamet. If you like what you hear, please do leave me a review on iTunes, and don't forget to not miss out on any of the chats still to come. Please do subscribe to When Orla Met.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.